stay down, and it has done, hasn't it?
It seems to be well.
That's lovely.
Yes,
what we were talking about, or what I think is interesting, is your experience from your early days in horseshoeing has stood you in good stead for the revival of interest in driving. If you'd like to tell us a bit more about that, I'd love to hear it, because I'm never tired of that.
Yeah, well, the show today is completely different than it was when I started nearly 60 years ago. In them days, horses were, they were all working horses, driving horses. You hardly ever see a riding horse. The ones they did ride were the ones they used to drive, that done the two jobs. But and that was a completely different way of life then to what that is now. The horses that are shod today, you see, they're all riding horses, and very few working horses.
Yes. But it's now a leisure hobby, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Whereas before, that the horse was equivalent to a motor today.
Yes.
That was a living.
It did the job of a tractor, it did the job of a van, a lorry, a car, everything.
Yeah.
Every form of transport, when you think about it.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And is it the different type of horse that makes it different for shooting today?
Oh, yeah.
Not the question of the same horse is doing a different job.
No, that's a different type of horse.
Yes.
The old-fashioned working horse is practically extinct.
Yes.
And the shires are still there, fairly strong still. The Suffolk horse has now gone on to the rare breeds register, do you see? Welsh cobs and things of that nature are coming back a bit now. They are building up now.
But would I be right in saying that the everyday working horse, the sort of general purpose working horse that people used years ago, people such as carriers, they would use horses which were crossbreds, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Not a purebred anything.
No.
They'd be good old heavy, honest, rough, hard-working horses.
It's
not like things of beauty, really, at all.
No.
You hardly ever see that type now, do you?
No.
Gypsies have them.
They
you still see gypsies with that
built
sort.
Built for strength for the jobs.
Yes. Work.
Yes. Purely for work and hardiness.
They're ornaments today. They aren't working horses.
That's right.
You put these horses into hard work today, they'd be dead within 3 months.
Would they?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes, the whole scene has altered. And as I say, observing this and watching Hector's work and how things have gone on over the years, as you know, there's been a tremendous revival of interest in driving. So many people have restored carts or have new ones built. And the young farriers who've never had the experience with driving horses, they have run into problems with keeping them going soundly and overcoming problems which crop up when horses are driven on the road a lot.
Mm. Yeah.
Would you like to tell us more about that?
I mean, that's completely different. The action of the horse is completely different. When you're riding a horse, you see the weight is all on the back, which have a tendency to open what we call the gate.
Yes.
The hind legs and the front.
Yes.
Have a tendency to open them, make them wider
apart
by the backs.
G-A-I-T.
That's right, that
by
kind
the back
of
swamping, do you see? Well, with the driving horse, that's completely opposite, because your vehicle behind the horse is pushing against it and have a tendency to hump the back,
really?
So that push the legs closer together, do you see?
Good
heavens.
And then they're more likely to hit the front legs with the back legs when they're going, especially going downhill.
Of course, there's a word in the trade for that, isn't there?
Forging.
Forging. It's a completely different use for the word forging.
Now, is it related to forging ahead in any way? Or is that where the forging ahead comes from, when you're really pushing?
It might well be. I would say the term forging ahead has come from the use of that word in relation to horses, I would say, because that dates back many, many years, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Because they do it when they're pushing ahead. They hit the front foot with the hind one. Occasionally you hear them do it when they're driving. It's quite a sharp crack you hear.
Mm. So that's completely different, you see. So the style of shearing is different, completely different.
If they do it too much, then the farrier's not doing a good job. And his job is to rebalance the shoe so that it just misses the front foot as it comes forward. Because if the horse is travelling fast on the road, he's at the trot. I mean, it isn't the done thing for driving horses to canter or gallop on the road. They never, ever should.
No.
But at the trot, when the legs are moving, the diagonals are moving, so of course the front and the hind foot come very close together at one point in the gait. Yeah. And if the shoe is slightly wrongly balanced, or the foot is slightly wrongly trimmed, then you get these troubles. You also get what we call brushing. Don't you? Tell Enid about that.
When they hit both legs together, like the hind legs, when they'll hit each other. They'll hit one hind leg with the other one.
They really wear they go to close. A sore place on the...
Like us banging our ankles together.
Yes. They do it on what we call the coronet, which is, of course, the little junction between the skin and the hair and the hoof. Very tender place. It's like the quick of our nail where the tissue grows from. And
the
they
front,
do damage the coronet.
On the front one, they do it on the knee, which is the... Do you see which is higher up?
Yes.
Yeah.
But the knee comes sort of out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Inside.
Yeah.
There's a
knobble.
Yes.
Yeah. Then that's what they call cutting. Yeah.
Yes. You'd never dream. And so people who go newly into horses need to know all this, or else they're going to be very unfair to the horse.
Well,
they should know.
They should know it.
But mainly it's the farrier's job to know.
Yes.
But because they don't do enough work to really create any problems today. Do you see what do they do? Somebody say, "Oh, we'll go out for a ride."
Yes.
They're out half an hour.
Yes.
Eh? We'll go out for a drive, probably out an hour. Whereas years ago, the horse used to come out the stable at 7 a.m. He wouldn't go back till probably 5 p.m.
Of course.
Probably later than that.
Mm-hmm.
He'd go, the driving horses, they'd probably go to Wicker Market Monday. Do you see the sale on the Monday? They'd go to Ipswich on the Tuesday. Wednesday they'd go to Bury. And Halesworth.
Yes.
Then they'd go to Norwich.
Full-time job.
Then they'd go to Norwich on the Saturday. I mean, they'd be doing probably anything up to 40 mile a day, wouldn't they?
Would be, yes.
And I mean, that was 6 days a week.
Yes.
But now they do 20 minutes, I think they've done wonders.
Yes.
They'll go from pub to pub, that's about it.
Yeah.
And you think of these four-in hands, for instance, Prince Philip.
Yes,
presumably those horses don't do long spells of that sort of driving.
No.
They'll be exercised in other ways,
exercised, normal exercise during the week, and then when they do these events, do you see? Because if you go back further enough, do you see, on these four-in hands were going from town to town, weren't they? I mean, they were the mail originally.
On the stagecoaches.
Stagecoaches.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, the horses, that's understandable. They can start off and probably don't knock themselves. But by the time they're done 20 or 30 miles pulling the load,
They're tired.
Mm-hmm. And then they start, and that's when the trouble starts.
Just as we do, walking a bit less carefully.
Yes, the same thing applies.
Mm.
Exactly.
Mm. And what about in those days, possibly a few still, when, you said gypsies, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Or let's say just odd tradesmen had a horse or a pony or whatever it was, pulling a cart round the streets with vegetables or with coal or something. What about the amount of care they would get from a farrier, those horses?
Well, they got reasonable care because, like I said, that was the owner knew that that was his livelihood.
That's the thing, I suppose. Yes.
I mean, he treated his horse. I mean, a lot of these horsemen, good horsemen, treated the horse better than they did the wife.
I wouldn't be surprised at that.
Oh yes.
Living in the East End, I wouldn't be surprised at that.
Oh yes, and they thought the world of their animals and
yes.
When you were in the trade, like mine, if you didn't do a good job, the man never come back to you. There was a blacksmith fairy in every village.
Yes.
Some villages had two. Mm-hmm. And if you didn't do the job properly, you didn't get the job. And if you didn't get the job, you went hungry.
Of course.
So that made you do it properly.
Yes.
Yes,
there was no, if you hadn't earned a shilling, you'd got nothing to eat, had you?
That's right. Necessity being a good driver.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Hector often quotes one particular instance which illustrates that very well. As recently as your time, after you were shoeing in your own business and everything, people often say, what did you used to charge? And it was 6 and 8 pence for a set of shoes on a heavy horse, a land horse, such as a Suffolk, as most of them were. But times were so tight that there was a farmer who used to send his horse with his horseman right past here and go another mile down the road to the next village, to Kettleborough, where there were two farriers there,
yeah.
And one of them was doing them a halfpenny cheaper.
Ooh.
6 and 7 pence halfpenny. And the farmer thought that it paid him to send them an extra mile each way, and really? The extra time that took to get them shot a halfpenny cheaper, and things were as tight as that.
As tight as that.
Yes.
I suppose, now what could that possibly be called, a false economy? What was he using
up
the
teeth? It probably was, actually.
That would be today.
Yes.
But in them days, there was no such thing as false economy. Economy didn't come into it, did it?
People didn't set the same cost value on time.
I was going to say, time didn't count in the same way.
It really didn't seem to. No. It's very funny that.
If you hadn't earned the money, well, you didn't go into it in detail and get the time and motion study in to look at the job, did you?
That's right.
We'd better pull ourselves together and see if we can put this right.
That's right.
You never really went into it to see where you'd lost the money.
No.
But you scrabbed a little harder so that you made ends meet.
That's right. By the result, you would see that you had to work a bit harder and you
there
put it
no,
back in.
No working out to see how you could do anything cheaper.
No.
Uh-huh.
But any economy that was made, or in the early days of Hector's business, I know, was always saving material rather than time. And the instinct remains, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Your instinct is to stave an odd bit of steel or iron off a bar, which the modern man would say, there's no point in saving that, because
that's
by the time you looked for it and found it when you want it, it would have paid you to cut a bit off a new bar.
That's it. Time costing as
much
as it now is.
Is the main driving thing, but in your early days, it was material,
every time.
Tell me, Enid, about some of the normal economies that were made, like making links into staples and all that sort of thing.
You see, we used to weld 1.5 old horseshoes together in the fire to make one new one again.
Really?
Oh, yes.
One turned the other way on top of the other?
We used to get one shoe and in the middle so that come to a half moon.
Yes.
Turn it over on itself. Then the other one we used to half and put the other piece in between the two and make a sandwich.
Golly, yes.
So you'd got a piece that shape, half moon.
Yes.
And that was all welded together in the fire into a straight bar.
You'd start all over
And then you start all over again.
Oh, I see. You didn't use that as a shoe. You then made it
reshape a new piece of metal.
Reused it as a shoe. Made another shoe out of it.
And that was a genuine economy then?
Yes. Old cart tires, we used to split them up the middle and make shoes.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Because they were made of the right kind of iron?
Yeah. Arrow teeth, you see, we used to, when the old shoes, you see, you could only use them a certain number of times by welding them up.
Yes.
After they got so you hadn't got more life in them, we used to weld short bits on the hair teeth.
Really?
Yeah.
Still all done in the fire.
Word.
Old chains, when they wore thin on the end, and we had to put a new link in, we never threw the two halves of the link away. We'd point them and made them into staples.
Really?
because the middle part of the link wasn't worn. You see, that's still a good bit of metal in it.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Isn't it tragic to think how far from that we've moved?
Yes, it is really. Mm. Yes,
to be so wasteful.
It's all throwaway now, isn't
yes.
it?
Yeah.
It seems morally wrong.
It hurts us who've known the other thing.
Yes,
it
does. Mm. It goes against the grain
and
terribly.
If that 5 minutes to five or 5 minutes to leaving off time, whatever it was, you wouldn't say, well, we'll get ready to go home. You'd pick a half a link up, make it into a staple, and throw it in the box.
Yes, that was ready for next time. You'd saved
that
time.
Yeah.
Yes. I forget what it was you used to make old horse rasps into, because for Carrier has a file with very, very coarse teeth one side and slightly less coarse on the other.
Yes.
It's used for rasping the hoof. I can't
remember
what
all
you
sorts
used
of things.
To use the old ones for.
Hooks and flashes.
Because that's a special hard steel,
it's
isn't
hard
it?
Steel,
it's not
yeah.
ordinary iron, is it?
It's used magnet flashes and hooks for hedge cutting and hose for chopping out sugar beet.
Yes, because of course you had all the equipment to shape it up anew, didn't you?
Yeah.
You could make whatever sort of shape you wanted from it.
That's an interesting thing, talking about the names of the tools too, flashers and hooks. Now,
you
in other parts
that.
Of the country, you would probably hear them called a slasher and a what?
I mean, nearly all people think a hook is a hook, don't they, for hanging things on.
Yes.
Well, in Suffolk, you see, a hook is a thing for cutting the hedge.
Yes, a curved sickle
shaped
thing.
Yes.
Yes.
Or a chopper.
Yes.
Yeah.
I see. And you just call that a hook?
Hook. Yeah.
So did you call the thing you were doing hooking or not?
What?
With a hook?
When
you're
using
say
it,
that you're hooking the hedge
you'd
or not?
You'd be hedging.
You're hedging.
Yeah,
yes,
hedging.
I see. Yes.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
tool was a separate name.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
And did you have to repair things? Well, you probably did. Farm instruments. I don't mean the big implements, but things like their scythes.
Oh, yes. We used to buy the scythe blades and do all the other ironwork on it, do you see? Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hoes and things like that were all handmade. Spuds, dock spuds, thistle spuds.
Have you come across
now,
a spud?
How would you spell that? S P A D.
That would be U D.
G-E?
I think it would be S P U D.
Oh, just a
yes.
spud.
Yes.
Spud.
I think
spud.
So. I think
really?
So.
The
dialect
not
word, really.
Not a spud. I heard the name spud.
No, it would be a spud,
no,
wouldn't
spud.
It?
Really?
It's probably in the dialect book. I haven't looked it up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And another good old word is the crone. Now, that was one I came across for the first time when I came into Suffolk, a crone. I jolly soon learnt what a crone was. I didn't ask. I waited to find out.
Have you learned a foreign
yes,
language, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes.
What was that?
Well, a crone is a...
He couldn't believe I didn't know what a crone was.
That's four, well, either two or four tines turned down on a long handle for pulling things out of the... I mean, like, when they used to...
I know what it is now.
When they used to put the muck on the fields, they used to put so many loads of the hake and so many heaps of the load. Or when they pulled it out of the tumbril, they pulled it out of the crone.
Like a fork bent at right angles.
Angles.
Oh.
Ideal thing for that job, you see. A
yes.
fork only bent over.
I see.
And the old, the real old gardeners, and I mean, well, every house had one, because they used to grow their own vegetables, didn't they?
That's right.
Well, when they dug the garden, after they dug it, they always chromed it down with a chrome before they planted it.
Really?
Used the chrome as a rake.
Mm-hmm. Now, could that be the same sort of thing that Noel bought last year when he saw one of the men in the village using it to pull out a lot of weed from undergrowth?
I expect so.
And it's got three prongs like that, and there's, I think, an arrowhead shape on each
prong.
Ah, that'd
be the modern one.
Yes,
that would be the modern
one.
Adaptation.
But, that'd be the
similar
modern
principle.
One.
It's excellent for getting up a lot of weed.
Yes.
Yeah.
The old style chrome would be a thing about as wide as that.
Yeah, about
it?
10 inches wide, and
mm-hmm.
the tines would be...
And the tines would be parallel.
Parallel.
Four tines, wouldn't
four.
They? And
for that
equidistant.
Ah, yes.
But for muck, pulling the muck out of the tumbril, they only had two.
Oh.
Two tines.
Did they?
Yeah.
More like a pitchfork bent at
right
angles then.
Angles.
That
yes.
would be a muck crone.
That'd be a muck
crone.
And was there a lot of straw in with that?
Oh, that was all straw, do you see?
Because otherwise you couldn't have pulled sort of muck without straw, could you?
No.
But straw, of course.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. and the tines on a macrome are flat, whereas the ones on an ordinary one for all the work were either round or square.
I see.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I came across these things, you see, when we were first married, because I used to write out all Hector's bills for him by hand before we had a typewriter. Mm-hmm. And of course I'd come across these words, you'd see, I'd think, you know.
Yes. Even to spell it in the first
place, you needed to know.
Yes,
I did have to guess a great deal, because no good looking in the dictionary for a lot of these things.
No.
I assumed that a crome was C-R-O-M-E, and I still do, because I've never come across anything else.
Well, I mean, all the dialect words are
phonetic,
spelt,
really, aren't they?
They're spelled
Helusheim.
They are spelled Helusheim,
so they can be spelt 10 different ways in the same village.
You'd still be right.
That's
because
right.
There's no dictionary spelling for a lot of them.
I'd spell it how I say it.
Mm. Yes.
Somebody up the road 100 yards would spell it how he say it.
I used to notice that.
It was phonetic spelling.
When the cards would from the workshop would come in, which the lads had done their work. I mean, one of them, I know dear old Pete in particular, he'd write for Crome, C-R-O-O-M, because that's how he'd say
for
it.
Crome.
Yes, but still right.
Very often the O in the Suffolk dialect goes to an O, doesn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes, whom?
Either a long O or a short O, like in room or room.
Mostly a short one, because that's a lazy language, the Suffolk dialect, isn't it?
I suppose it is in a way.
I suppose you a lot of dialect is.
Cut everything short, don't you?
Yes.
Mm. Oh,
yes,
yeah.
You do. But it's quite different from the unpleasantly lazy speech that you get now. For instance, Lancashire.
Yes.
It's not true Lancashire that's spoken up there. It's a lazy, you know, up the city, sort of thing.
Yes.
Nothing like
no,
the
no.
dialect.
Yes, same as the what you get on the outskirts of London, the home counties.
Yes.
I call that ugly too.
It is.
True Cockney is a treat to listen to.
That's
but
right.
But there's a lot of adulterated Cockney in the home counties. I used to hear it a lot in Hertfordshire.
Yes.
Especially in the war, because the evacuees, of course, would come along, and of course all the local children picked it up. Of course they did. We'd all go home talking like them, and our mothers complained. But it was interesting all the same. It was interesting to hear them.
Indeed.
Yes.
But there's a thousand pities to see the dialects are going, and they'll soon be gone. And one thing which annoyed me, a Scotsman or a Welshman or an Irishman can go on television, they'll accept them, and they can talk their
lingo. You mean as a newsreader
as a presenter of a programme, don't you?
Exactly.
Mm. And yet if anybody go on there with a Suffolk dialect, they won't have them there.
That's true,
because they aren't talking Queen's English.
It's taking a long time for dialects to be accepted, but I think that boundary is giving way,
frankly. Well, I hope it will universally, because I feel the Scots make a tremendous fuss about their speech and their traditions.
Yeah.
You never hear, on the whole, the Englishman saying, but I'm English.
Mm. No, you don't.
Do you?
We're too self-effacing.
And yet they'll accept the big boys, the television and radio, and they'll accept top jobs.
Mm.
And yet if you go for a top job in the city or anywhere and start talking in the Suffolk dialect,
you're made a laugh of.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's very
it
true.
Is extraordinary.
It's also true that up in Scotland they don't like to hear English accents on their television and news.
Well, I never.
They much prefer to have their own people.
Oh.
But how often do we listen to a Scottish accent?
Yeah.
And every time a trade unionist comes on, I'm afraid we've got a little phrase, another bloody Scot, we say.
Yeah, well, you do.
The roughest of the trade unionists.
Yes.
Are pretty well fine
Scots.
They are.
So we've been perhaps a little bit reticent about our dialects.
Yeah.
Yes. I think it's time they...
But I'm not going to change if anybody doesn't accept me, Mr.
And you can't say that it's hard to understand, because I'm a Londoner. For a long time I have been.
Yeah.
And you never say anything that I don't understand, unless you were to use a word like crone.
An actual word that you've never come across.
Mm.
But after all, once is enough, and once you know, don't
exactly.
you? You don't forget.
No.
No.
You don't.
No. No, I found, coming into Suffolk from Hertfordshire, I hadn't heard any East Anglian dialect before at all. I didn't find it difficult. There were only two cases, and I can remember thinking there were two people, one of whom is still alive, who I had great difficulty in understanding, and I thought, when I can follow both of them without any difficulty, I shall know I really belong.
Yes.
And it didn't take long with one of them, and that was Dennis. And the other one, I don't know whether you knew him, I think he lived in Earlsholm for a time, didn't he?
Monkshelm.
Chap called Ben.
I expect he was dead.
Word, he was difficult to follow.
Yeah. Was he?
Yes. He spoke fast. That was the problem.
Yes.
Most Suffolk people don't.
No,
they give
they
you
don't.
Time to listen and time to think.
They
but
do.
He spoke quickly with a very strong accent, and
yes.
that took me a lot of years before I could. I was so pleased when once I was able to say to you, Ben had been in the shop and we'd had a chat, hadn't we?
Yeah.
You and me and him and Joe. Was another one, and we'd had a chat for a long, long time, and I said to him afterwards, I was able to understand everything he said.
Wonderful.
I was so pleased.
Such an achievement.
Yes.
You know, one thing that's striking me at this moment, actually, when you talk about when you came into Suffolk mm-hmm. and you met Hector, and you told me once before you had no eyes for anyone else.
That's
then.
Right. Perfectly true.
In these days when so large a proportion of marriages breaks down,
mm.
It seems to me that the marriage that has an interesting occupation, let's say, in the man's hands,
mm-hmm.
if you like,
mm-hmm.
Although you've got your own artistic contribution, which you also combine with
true, yes,
as
that
well.
Has been a great strength to us.
Oh, I think that's a tremendous
yes.
strength to a marriage.
Yes, yes.
I feel the same with Noel.
Yes.
If there's something really interesting that you have
yes.
between
yeah.
the two of you,
yes. yeah.
You don't give up at the first.
Of course
little,
you
no,
don't. It
no.
makes an incredible bond,
doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I feel that.
Yes, yeah. yes.
It is a recipe for a good marriage.
Oh,
yeah.
yes, yes.
It really
and
is.
I think about it a great deal because it's a very strange thing to talk about. But when I came to Suffolk, I might have told you this before, I had hardly been away from home at all. I was only 17 when I first met him.
Mm.
And I had a very sheltered life. I was an only child. I hadn't been around much. I hadn't stayed away from home. And I came to Suffolk to visit a girl pen friend who was working at Brandeston Hall. And she at that time was expecting to get engaged to a chappie in the village here who was and still is a friend of Hector's and ours, and they didn't marry in the finish, but she at that time wanted me to come up to Suffolk to see her and to meet this chappie who she thought she was going to marry. And so it was holiday from the art school where I was, and I thought, well, why not? I'll venture. And her parents said yes, that would be all right. And so I came along, and of course it happened that he was in the forge talking to Hector on the first evening I came, and that was how we met.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an extraordinary thing. But added to that, I can well remember staying at Kettleborough Checkers and walking along from Kettleborough to Brandeston the very next morning after I'd come here, and I think it was quite likely before we'd actually met. I don't know whether it was the first day or the second that
probably.
We met in the shop
no,
there.
No.
But the strong impression I have is walking over the hill from Kettleborough, where the gun club now is, walking down into this valley and seeing that view of this little end of the village nestling in the hollow. And I can remember feeling a extraordinarily strong sensation that I could easily live there.
Yes.
I could belong there.
Yes.
And I had never felt it anywhere else, and I've never felt it since.
Isn't that wonderful?
But there was something that felt right.
Yes, I really believe in
yes.
that feeling, a sense of belonging.
Most extraordinary.
I belong here.
Yes, because
yes.
I hadn't been around much. I hadn't been away from home.
Really?
And it was quite forcible.
Yes,
and
marvellous.
Yes.
I think if one's receptive to things like that,
yes.
you know, it's
yes.
it strikes
yes.
you, doesn't
yes.
it?
Yes,
mm.
it does. There was a rightness about
and
it.
And you don't forget it, because
no.
you're young enough to be so impressed by it.
Yes.
Yes, that's
yes,
wonderful.
There was a rightness about it. Okay. I've felt that same sense of rightness at many times over these years. This is now our 37th year?
38.
This is 1992.
Yeah.
This will be our 38th year in December. So it's several. there have been times doing work which we have worked on together, different jobs, when I have thought, yes, this is what I'm here for.
Yes.
Very, very strongly.
Yes.
And never, never more so than, of course, working on the sword stand.
Yes.
Never more so than that.
That was wonderful, wasn't it?
The work I've done in the past, the training I've had, the experience I've had with Hector and his work, that was all leading up to that.
All coming to it.
It all came together.
Yes, I can quite see that
feeling.
It all
came together.
Because that was a whole thing, wasn't it?
It was a culmination.
The connection with the city.
It was.
The ancientness of the actual thing you were copying.
The significance of what it was for.
Absolutely.
Yes,
absolutely.
Everything about it.
And now, of course, it sits in America with a sword in it on certain occasions.
Yeah.
It's a permanent tribute to your collaboration.
It's an
forever in America.
It is an extraordinary thing, and an amazing sensation it's been, isn't it? Yes.
It's wonderful.
Yes. And.